Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. The Romans once used it for jewelry, but for most of our history, coal has been a source of fuel that has not only given us heat and power, but also driven industrial and economic expansion. The history of coal will be the subject of our interview this week with Barbara Fries. After which, for our commentary of the week, John Pinero addresses what he considers to be the quagmire cliché, as drawn from American involvement in Vietnam and applied to our engagement in Iraq. But first, Dan Roberts, in another moment in time, offers us the first in a two-part series on William Jennings Bryan and his cross of gold.
During the election of 1896, American voters just about lost control of themselves, all over the question of money, silver or gold.
A Moment in Time with Dan Roberts.
In 1893, the U.S. sank into the worst financial depression the nation had yet experienced. Banks failed, farmers lost their holdings, and President Grover Cleveland, just beginning his second non-consecutive term, saw his long-held dreams of reform shattered by the stricken economy. All his efforts to revive business and lift the national spirit came to grief, and by 1896, Cleveland was even rejected for his party's nomination. Instead, the Democrats chose a champion of free silver, a little-known congressman from Nebraska. He won by getting out in front of a tidal wave. The burning issue of the campaign of 1896 was money, its quantity and quality. There were no credit cards in the 1890s, no ATMs, very few banks, and many of them were thought to be shady operations, not very friendly to the average American seeking loans or paying debts. Even paper money was considered suspect, tainted, not the genuine article. Real money was precious metal, gold, and to a lesser degree, silver. Producers, especially wheat and cotton farmers, had seen the price for what they sold plummet, while the things they were buying, loans, freight charges, and manufactured goods, were increasing in cost. Many producers believed that if there were more dollars in circulation, the price of their wheat would go up and the price of their farm tools would go down. True or not, they believed it to be true with a religious fervor, and they found a champion. Next time, the Cross of Gold. At the University of Richmond, this is Dan Roberts.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, Russia's Ministry of Education has decided to remove its seal of approval from a high school textbook that encourages students to research and discuss controversial topics in Russian history, signaling what some believe is a new conservative ideology in the nation's schools. In one textbook assignment, students are directed to discuss and provide evidence for one of the following two statements. President Vladimir Putin is an authoritarian ruler bent on establishing a new dictatorship in Russia. Or, President Putin is a Democrat at heart whose structural reforms are paving the way for Russia to emerge as a liberal democracy. Igor Dolutsky, author of the textbook, believes that the Ministry of Education considers this textbook to be Russophobic, that it undercuts the collectivist values of the Russian people, and that it inculcates individualistic Western values that are alien to the Russian people. A spokesman for the Ministry of Education denied the charge, explaining that the decision was made because of a panel of experts found the textbook to be unbalanced and inappropriate on a number of topics, including its treatment of the former NKVD secret police during World War II and the actions of Russian soldiers in the Chechen War. The textbook has been in use for over a decade. Coal has been a major commodity in history, but until now, little has been written about it except to tout or denigrate the role it played in the Industrial Revolution. Our guest this week takes a broader perspective. She's Barbara Fries, and Talking History's Fred Nielsen spoke to Ms. Fries by telephone from her home in St. Paul, Minnesota.
According to my guest, Barbara Fries, coal is a commodity utterly lacking in glamour. It's dirty, old-fashioned, domestic, and cheap. Yet this mundane commodity has driven industrial and economic expansion, stimulated class conflict, built empire, and transformed the planet. A deep, rich vein of coal runs through human history, Ms. Fries concludes, and it underlies many of the hardest decisions our world now faces. A former assistant attorney general in Minnesota, Barbara Fries is the author of Coal, A Human History. Ms. Fries, welcome.
Thank you.
Coal itself is millions of years old. The ancient Romans, it turns out, used it for jewelry. When and how did humans start using it as fuel?
Well, in fact, it took quite a while for people to start using it as fuel after they started using it as jewelry. The first to burn it steadily were the Chinese, probably back around the 3rd century B.C. Interestingly, they, too, had been carving it for some 4,000 years. There's evidence in the record of what were called Neolithic ear-piercing ornaments dating to about 4,000 B.C. And after about 4,000 years of carving it, and probably as their trees started to disappear, because we know deforestation began in China a long time ago, they started burning coal.
Whatever its utility as fuel, coal, you write, had a terrible image problem in Europe in the Middle Ages. It was associated with disease, death, the devil. Many people despised its smell. And,
that's true.
What's going on here, and why do they use it anyway?
Well, there were a lot of things going on. As far as the image problem, one problem was the fact, as you mentioned, that they despised its smell. It smelled, of course, of sulfur. The name they had for sulfur, the traditional name, is brimstone. It was mined from these deep, dark mines that they all believed were haunted by demons. And so it had a very demonic kind of sinister aspect to it. And also, as it happened, when the bubonic plague swept through Europe, the main symptom, the most grisly sort of memorable symptom, were these things called the buboes, the swollen lymph glands that became black and very painful, and they were described as burning like a lump of coal and looking like a lump of coal. So in addition to having this terrible smell and these demonic connections, it was linked to the bubonic plague, at least in that sense.
You say that it's hard to imagine a more dismal and dangerous workplace than a 17th century coal mine in Europe. Could you describe that for us? What was it like?
Well, one thing that surprised me in looking into this was the many ways one could die in one of these ancient coal mines. You could find yourself dying, of course, from cave-ins. You could find yourself poisoned by CO2, which would simply smother you, and it was exuded by the coal itself. Often the coal mines would explode by the flammable gases that would accumulate there. And also, you could drown in a coal mine because they would frequently find themselves with mines filling up with water, either groundwater seeping in or breaking through to some other kind of collection of water underground. And, of course, that's still a concern, as we saw quite recently in Pennsylvania.
Well, you describe in your book how this kind of work drives a wedge between the classes. There are times even when the government is not allowed to talk about it or won't allow other people to talk about the harm done to the miners.
Oh, that's right. There was a time in Newcastle in particular, I believe it was the 18th century, when the mine operators asked the local newspaper to stop mentioning these fiery explosions that occurred underground and killed hundreds of people at a time. And the newspaper printed very candidly their decision that they just weren't going to mention these things anymore because they thought it would have very little good tendency. So it was no longer in the papers.
Could the Industrial Revolution have occurred without coal?
I don't think it could have. Certainly not the Industrial Revolution as it happened, with this very concentrated pulse of industrialization, the concentration of labor, the concentration of production in these new industrial cities. That required a very concentrated coal, or rather a very concentrated source of energy, and that was coal. And there really was no other game in town, so to speak, that could have taken its place.
How does that change things? It changes, obviously, the nature of work, and I would think where the factories themselves can be placed.
Absolutely. Before coal, there were some factories, but they had to be run on water power. And that meant that they were of a certain limited size and a limited speed, and they had to be dispersed throughout the countryside where you had rivers that were untamed, and you would bring a small labor force out there to work in these sorts of water-run factories. But with coal, there was this very sudden shift from water power to coal power, of course, and that meant that you could have these new masses of labor in the cities. And so that really led to a tremendous urbanization and then tremendous social change. And I should say that coal was more than just the fuel behind the machinery. Coal led directly to the development of the steam engine, which was this critical invention that finally let humanity turn fuel and heat into motion. So, and it was that steam engine that allowed all the other machines in the factory to run. So it was really quite critical in that way as well.
There's a difference between oil and coal. While there are fortunes that are supposed to be made from coal, it's oil that makes us drawn to the idea of great wealth. Striking oil, you remind us, is a metaphor for sudden wealth. But coal makes us think more often of the poor rather than the rich. Perhaps more, nowhere is that more clear than in places like Manchester and the coal-fired industries of 19th century Britain.
Right. Well, one of the very first things that happened with the Industrial Revolution was the creation of cities like Manchester, where you had hundreds and hundreds of factories. In that case, they were spinning cotton. And you had hundreds of smokestacks. And so even though these were not coal miners, I think of it as very much a coal culture. They were there because of coal. And, of course, the city was very thick with smoke. And the people lived lives that, in not just my opinion, but that of, say, Alexis de Tocqueville, who wrote about it at the time, were diminished in virtually every way possible. This was also, by the way, where the ideology of communism took root in a very real way, and that's because Friedrich Engels came from Germany to Manchester to work in his dad's cotton mill. His father had been a partner in a cotton mill there. Engels didn't really want to learn how to run a cotton mill, but he was already anticipating a workers' revolt, and he believed it would start in Manchester, and he wrote a very influential book describing the conditions there, and then, of course, later went on to collaborate with Karl Marx in the Communist Manifesto.
The costs of using coal seem obvious to us. Apart from Engels and people like him, were those costs obvious in the 19th century? Did people care very much about health, about extraordinarily dirty cities?
Well, I think I have to say yes and no. Some of the costs were absolutely obvious and more obvious than they are to us today because the smoke was so acute in these cities, and so everyone knew it was there. They had soot on their skin, on their clothing, on everything in the city. And it had been assumed as far back as the 1600s, at least in London, that coal smoke was killing multitudes, and that is almost surely true. And some people did care. There was a lot of concern about the air quality in London, and people wrote about how it was certainly the worst in Europe, and it was really diminishing their quality of life. But they, I think, didn't believe they had any choice. So you could either say they didn't care enough or they simply took a kind of fatalistic approach to it.
Is it possible that the perceived benefits were more important to them than the perceived costs?
Oh, I think it's certain that that was the case. And of course, part of your question, an important part, is the term perceived. I think we could have a debate about whether or not that was true.
The United States joins the party in the 19th century, too. It gets dirty cities. Pittsburgh is extraordinarily filthy. But it also becomes the world leader in coal production by the 1890s, you note, and by 1900, coal provided over 70% of the nation's energy. You suggest that coal was the unrivaled foundation of U.S. power by the turn of the century.
Yes, and I don't think there can be much question about that. As you say, it was over 70% of the nation's energy. Wood was the next leading source of energy. That was at about 20%, and that was dropping. Oil and gas and hydropower were barely on the charts at that point. So at that point, if you wanted to be an industrial power, you had to be burning a lot of coal, and that would be true during that moment in history of the United States, Britain, and the third biggest coal-burning power was Germany, which, of course, sets us up for the conflicts of the first half of the 20th century.
At about the same time, around 1900, American reformers, many of them women, interestingly enough, campaigned for laws limiting coal smoke. What were their goals, and how successful were they?
I think this is a wonderful chapter in American history, and I hope more people will become familiar with it. It turned out that the people who first started campaigning against smoke and what they called the smoke abatement campaigns were, in fact, women, mainly middle-class women who had joined civic organizations that formed in a lot of American cities. And on a city-by-city basis, they campaigned for ordinances that would force people to, if not stop burning coal, at least burn it in ways that created less smoke. And they were successful enough to get about 75 ordinances in various cities. they were able to reduce coal smoke, I think, pretty substantially. There was one estimate in Pittsburgh that it had been cut nearly in half. But most of this progress occurred before World War I. And when the war came, concerns about air quality were put way down on the list, and the skies became quite smoky again.
It becomes an early example of environmental protection laws, I suppose.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I think a lot of our current environmental protection laws derive in part from that time in our history. It's interesting, of course, because they knew there were health issues involved with coal. Some of their understanding of the health issues were quite accurate. They knew it led to lung disease, for example. They also had some rather strange ideas that it caused a variety of ailments we no longer link with air pollution, baldness and tooth decay, for example. And they also had, the campaign took on these very strong moral overtones. It was thought that coal was a form of dirt, and dirt led to moral depravity. And so the debate included issues like, you know, what percentage of the murders in Chicago would be caused by coal smoke. And it was definitely thought that there was a strong link there.
Well, to the extent that many of the reformers are women, it's, I suppose, worth noting, at least in passing, that once again we have the women cleaning up after the men.
Well, you know, that is not just a coincidence. They had taken this concept of housekeeping that they had been trained in for decades, and they had understood it was their job to protect their family's health and morality by keeping the home clean, and they took that concept out into the cities.
You worked as an attorney for the state of Minnesota for, I believe, 12 years,
mm-hmm.
was it? One of your cases focused on coal's environmental impact in the present. I wonder how the past, that is the history of coal, became important to you.
Yes, well, that's sort of an interesting thing that happened to the book. I actually had planned to initially write a book that was mainly about modern environmental problems related to coal, primarily climate change, which is a problem of civilization-threatening magnitude and one that I felt it was important to address. And I thought I'd have a chapter or two of history as background. When I started researching the history, I just found it to be so interesting. And perhaps more important than that, I started to look at the story as really one big, long, sweeping story, with coal playing this central role all along, both as a very constructive force shaping our civilization and as a very destructive force imposing on us tremendous hardships and costs along the way. So suddenly, instead of becoming a sort of modern environmental book, it became a much broader story that swept across various centuries and from history to science, et cetera. And that was my goal. It felt like telling only part of the story would be a mistake and would be losing some of the essential drama of it.
After several thousand years, partly as jewelry and more often as fuel, it would seem King Coal's been dethroned. Coal, you observe, is less compatible with modern technologies and consumer demands than oil or natural gas. Does it matter much anymore, or should coal be consigned to the dustbin of history?
Oh, its history is definitely not over yet. I think that we may find that the last chapter of coal's history is beginning, but we can be pretty sure this is going to be a very long and controversial chapter. America, modern America, burns more coal than it ever has. It burns it in power plants, so it is invisible to most people. And the coal industry is fairly invisible to most people if you compare it, say, to the oil industry. But because we burn so much coal and because coal contributes so substantially to climate change, we're going to be seeing a lot of debate about coal in the years to come. And part of that is going to be because right now, for the first time in a long time, America actually has several new coal plants in the planning stages, and that is that makes America unique among most of the developed nations. It puts us in the category of, say, China, which is also relying very heavily on coal and plans to use it to provide electricity to its enormous population. So we're going to be seeing some very major disputes over coal, and I think they're going to be geopolitical disputes as much as simple environmental ones.
One of the themes of your book is that people throughout history can't seem to decide sometimes whether coal is a product of the devil or a gift from God.
It is something
that has both creative and destructive powers. I wonder, on balance, how you would evaluate it yourself, having studied it. Would it be better for us to have left it in the ground?
You know, I address this briefly in the book, and I kind of evade really answering it. I think that had we left it in the ground, we would have seen a much more gradual and perhaps much more humane kind of industrialization. But keep in mind that before industrialization, there were a lot of evils that were associated with the agrarian world. Slavery, for example. I think if we did not have coal, we might have had slavery for much longer than we actually did, because ultimately the coal gave us the industrialization that allowed us to displace those sorts of slave-based systems. So I think, I feel like I have to be kind of humble about trying to imagine what the world would have been like without coal. Though I should say that as far as the 21st century is concerned, I feel quite strongly that we're to the point where we do need to pretty aggressively move away from coal, start replacing it with some of the options that we now have. But the larger question about the net balance over history, that's a hard one, and I haven't resolved it.
Well, we should leave it there then. Thank you, Ms. Fries.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Barbara Fries, the author of Coal, A Human History.
Well, I was born a coal miner's daughter in a cabin on a hill in Butcher Holler. We were poor, but we had love. That's the one thing that Daddy made sure of. He shoveled coal to make a poor man's dollar.
Critics often draw analogies between the Vietnam War and any other war in which there's concern that we might be drawn into a protracted, bloody military engagement from which we cannot escape. Our guest this week, John Pinheiro, considers it a less than useful quagmire cliche when applied to Iraq. Pinheiro is a professor of history at the University of Virginia.
Many Americans look no further into their past than the Vietnam War for instructive analogies about Iraq. They had better start looking further. Comparisons of Iraq with the Vietnam quagmire obscure rather than clarify what's needed to win the peace in Iraq. The Vietnam War was fundamentally different from Operation Iraqi Freedom. It pitted Americans and South Vietnamese against the Soviet-supported North Vietnamese and Viet Cong guerrillas. Many Vietnamese viewed their fight as a war of independence. In Iraq, on the other hand, coalition forces faced terrorists committed not to independence, but actually to blocking Iraq's road to democratic self-rule. The obsession with avoiding quagmires helped create the problems America now faces. Fear of getting bogged down led Americans to flee Beirut in 1983, Somalia in 1994, and to respond to deadly terrorist attacks in 1998 only with ineffective cruise missiles. These actions convinced terrorists the U.S. lacked the will to engage in a ground war. To find a truly instructive analogy to the current situation, we have to look all the way back to the Mexican War of 1846 to 1848. In that war, Americans for the first time occupied a nation different in language, religion, and basic cultural assumptions. Americans discovered in Mexico the danger of mixing religious rhetoric with military action. Many blamed Roman Catholicism for Mexico's political and economic troubles, and evangelical Protestants called for the Catholic Church's destruction there. This convinced Mexicans that the U.S. Army had come to destroy their religion. American generals avoided violent unrest only by personally reassuring Mexican clerics and issuing proclamations guaranteeing religious rights to Mexican citizens. Today, some Americans argue that Muslims are incapable of democracy, even as leading evangelicals call for missionaries to exploit occupied Iraq. Still others have requested that President Bush immediately withdraw American troops. Such statements endanger U.S. soldiers. The former leads some Iraqis to believe al-Qaeda's accusation that America seeks to destroy Islam, while the latter reassures terrorists their attacks are breaking American will. When American troops departed Mexico in 1848, they left it easy prey to an impending French invasion. Besides illustrating the good sense of taking seriously Iraqis' religious beliefs, the Mexican War, then, reminds us of the need for a real victory in Iraq, not the quick exit wanted by anti-war protesters. President Bush claims he intends to make Iraq a stable, democratic force in the troubled Middle East. Such an outcome would demonstrate American willpower. It would save future American lives and ensure that those lost remain honorable sacrifices and not become wasted deaths. A democratic Iraq is the only victory worth having.
You've been listening to John Pinero, Professor of History at the University of Virginia and Assistant Editor of the Papers of George Washington. Pinero's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. This is Talking History. And finally, we continue our reading of parts of the unpublished Civil War diary of Edwin R. Wilmarth, Union soldier in the 40th Massachusetts Infantry, imprisoned at Andersonville Prison in Georgia. In this week's passage, rumors begin to spread among the prisoners that Union General Sherman is marching into Georgia and that they may soon be free. June 20th, 1864. The rebels are in quite a flutter outside today. They're throwing up fortifications and are being made to repel any force coming from the railroad. They doubtless are getting ready for the Union cavalry raid. Three or four Negroes were whipped today, the first Negro flogging I've ever seen. 100 slaves are employed on the earthworks, very cloudy around that region. Men, women, and children are coming in from some place, and quite a settlement grown up within 2 days past. We hear that Sherman is driving every family before him. We hope so. The families are living in tents and rude huts. In this part of the country, the people can see and suffer. They can realize the hardships of war, such as they can only be imagined and not described by our own loyal people in the North. July 21st, the rebels are still fortifying and have commenced three large forts, two on the east and one on the north side. July 22nd, nothing new today, have not seen any of Sherman's cavalry yet, but hope to soon. It's hope on hope ever in this place, and he that comes into this place must do so, or he will certainly fall a victim to the rebels' fiends. July 23rd, hours, days, and weeks roll by, and still we are in the most filthy place I've ever known, Andersonville.
And I wish God he'd have killed me then.
And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. As always, we welcome your comments on this program or suggestions for future shows, which you can send us by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. A Moment in Time is produced by Dan Roberts and distributed by WCVE-FM in Richmond, Virginia. For more information, visit amomentintime.com. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.
And they can bear